I want to preach this morning on Easter within the context of the world of nature. Human beings, after all, are part of nature. Indeed, our seventh principle, UU principle, calls us to respect the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. That is, to respect the world of nature. Now, I enjoy preaching on Easter, trying to make sense of Christianity's resurrection symbolism in a way that contemporary Unitarian Universalists can appreciate and understand. And this is not always an easy task. Not that our tradition has nothing to say on the subject. Unitarians and Universalists have long celebrated Easter, and many UUs still rejoice at its annual return. But we do not tend, anyway, pretty significantly, do not rejoice in the same way or for the same reasons that Orthodox Christians rejoice. For the Orthodox, or most of them at any rate, Easter celebrates Jesus' triumph over death and ascension into heaven. For us, it celebrates, and when I say us, I just say the kind of consensus of Unitarian Universalist opinion and theological opinion. It celebrates the eternal return of spring in nature, and also, as we're part of nature, in the human heart. And the human heart's a miraculous thing, like Babushka keeps saying. It's a miracle. Now, the human heritage goes back far beyond biblical Palestine, or even the conventionally recognized 8,000 years or so of recorded history. Human beginnings go back at least 2 million years to the appearance of the first true human beings, the earliest species composing the genus Homo. Only in the last moment of human history, writes the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and biologist Edward O. Wilson, only in the last moment of history has the delusion arisen that people can flourish apart from the rest of the living world. Pre-literate societies were in intimate contact with a bewildering array of life forms. For countless generations, our ancestors lived in small Paleolithic bands, hunting and gathering, mating and giving birth, dying, and somehow carrying on. Advances occurred very slowly over the course of millennia. Simple tools, clothing, the capture of fire, and with the arrival of the Neolithic, the domestication of seeds and animals. Throughout this long, slow ascent, we remained close to nature and sensitive to its rhythms and symmetry. We had to stay alive. Now, this is still true, if less immediately obvious. In our modern urban existence, we can delude ourselves that we're apart from nature, but only at our peril. The late San Francisco Renaissance poet and nature lover, Kenneth Rexroth's poem, Another Spring, captures what it must have felt like to be among these ancient ancestors of ours, lying beside the embers of a campfire on a late March or early April night. The seasons revolve and the years change with no assistance or supervision. The moon, without taking thought, moves in its cycle, full crescent, full. The white moon enters the heart of the river. The air is drugged with azalea blossoms. Deep in the night, a pine cone falls. Our campfire dies out in the empty mountains. The sharp stars flicker in the tremulous branches. The lake is black, bottomless in the crystalline night. High in the sky, the northern crown is cut in half by the dim summit of a snow peak. Oh, heart, heart, so singularly intransigent and corruptible, here we lie entranced by the starlit water, and moments that should last forever slide unconsciously by us like water. Sublime. Here's the thing. I mean, I'm a camper, so I just love it. Here's the thing. We are part of nature. And it's part of us. The very same chemical reactions that happen in trees and in the soil also happen inside of us. In fact, as we all learned in biology class, drawing a definitive line between one's inside and one's outside is impossible. The air we breathe, the food we've eaten, all are these inside or outside of our bodies? Hard to say. Alan Watts regularly joked about people being egos inside bags of skin. But he did so because he realized how hopelessly inaccurate and unscientific such a description really is. What we actually are, to begin with, is the whole of our bodies. What we actually are is our minds, our bodies, our whole physical, psychic being altogether. And our bodies cannot exist except in a certain kind of natural environment. We require air of a certain temperature and nutrition of a certain kind. We require a certain kind of planet to dwell on, one that spins regularly around a certain kind of warm star in a harmoniously and rhythmic manner in order for our life to go on. This arrangement is just as essential to the existence of our bodies as are our internal organs, our heart, brain, lungs, and so forth. So there's really no way of separating ourselves from the natural environment in which we live. We can make the distinction linguistically, but not scientifically. What this means is that our bodies go with the natural environment as a unified field. It's helpful to think of the two as going together in the same way that bees and flowers go together. We know that flowers and bees are separate entities. Flowers grow out of the ground. Bees fly around and buzz. But where there are no flowers, there are no bees, and vice versa. Boston Globe columnist Linda Weltner, a member of the UU Church of Marblehead, Massachusetts, quoted the cosmologist Brian Swim in one of her newspaper columns. One of the underlying principles of the universe, Weltner writes, is communion. The way in which all aspects of creation are in profound relationship to one another. It is this communion aspect of existence that allows us to digest plants, to decipher the language of people halfway around the world, to have love affairs with our pets. It's why we thrill to the sight of snow-topped mountains when we might just as easily be indifferent. We come with an inborn response to nature that requires only the right stimulus to leap into being. That's the reason that all it takes to convince humankind of the value of whales is to give enough people a glimpse of one. Our ancestors clearly knew this, that we were intimately connected to everything else. Native Americans understand it to this day. But all too often, modern European-descended Americans have forgotten that in our own pulse beats every stranger's veins, ours and theirs linked together, and also within the flowered ground beneath our feet. Dylan Thomas put it perfectly. The force that through the green fuse drives the flower, drives my green age, that blasts the roots of trees is my destroyer. And I am dumb to tell the crooked rose my youth is spent by the same winter fever. The force that drives the water through the rocks drives my red blood. The green fuse of the flower stem fuses each of our lives to that of nature. But it is also the fuse that will blast our green youths to decrepitude and ultimately brings wintry death to all that ever lived or will live. How to accept that fact, that we're going to die like everything else in life? This is where religion comes in. Anthropologists and archaeologists assume that artifacts from humanity's earliest burial sites are evidence of the beginnings of religion. Our ancestors knew that they were going to die, and they performed elaborate rituals to make the transition easier. Easier both for the people facing death and for those left behind in grief. Eventually, humanity's long ascent leads to the discoveries of agriculture, cities, written language, civilization. Such a gift, such a wonder. But great, wonderful gift that civilization is, it has also and increasingly separated us from the world of nature. Moreover, despite all that civilization provides, it hasn't made facing our mortality one bit easier. We still die, everyone. What religion tells us about facing death, from my point of view, is pretty simple. Look around, say the various faith traditions. What do you see? Yes, everything alive dies. But look closely. Life keeps coming back. The specific individual forms don't return, but life returns, and with it new incarnations of the same form, again and again. Year after year. And that, as I gleaned from the various languages of faith, is the real resurrection. William Hazlitt was an English Unitarian, literary critic, and close friend to the poets William Wordsworth and Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Hazlitt wrote, "I love to see the trees first covered with leaves in the spring, the primroses peeping out from some sheltered bank, and the innocent lambs running races on the soft green turf, because at the birth time of nature, I have always felt sweet hopes and happy wishes." In 4 weeks, on April 24th, our Sunday service will focus on Passover, the 4,000-year-old pastoral spring festival that came to be associated with the story of Exodus. A story about skipping over of the Jewish people on the eve of their escape from Egypt. Protected, the story holds, by the blood of the Paschal Lamb sprinkled about their front doors. About the same time, 12,000 BCE, the Jewish people adopted a covenant. As their faith transformed over the centuries from a family to a tribal and thence to a national religion, Passover grew into a major Jewish festival. This morning, we celebrate Easter. Easter is usually the same week as Passover, but once in a while, like this year, 2016, the two celebrations are a month apart. Next month, we'll look at Passover, but today I want to consider Easter. I want to see if I can crack open some of the metaphors and some of the power found in the Easter myth. For Christians, Orthodox Christians, Easter commemorates the death and resurrection of Jesus. We know enough from reliable scholarship to conclude that there almost certainly was, in fact, an actual person, Jesus, a poet and healer who was put to death by Roman authorities around 30 CE. His message included proclaiming the kingdom. There's the kingdom of man, the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, the reign of the Spirit. And he taught with the use of parables, these koan-like stories, somewhat enigmatic, but that arrest your attention and kind of get you wondering what they mean. As he and his followers were all devout and loyal Jews, they surely celebrated Passover. And indeed, all the Gospels say this. In the Gospel of Mark, the oldest account, as well as in Luke and Matthew, the Last Supper clearly is Passover. In the Gospel of John, however, the meal occurs one day earlier, on the day of preparation. John weaves a new myth, the myth of Jesus as the world's paschal lamb. In the period we're talking about, 2,000 years ago and earlier, no prayer meant anything unless accompanied by a sacrifice. So for the mythmakers of that time, putting the Last Supper on the day of preparation transformed their martyred hero into the sacrifice that redeemed and still redeems all humanity from the original sin, that is, the sin of self-conscious awareness. For it is self-conscious awareness that brings with it not only knowledge of our mortality, but feelings some of the time, oftentimes, of being out of sync, self-conscious in the world of nature. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Even Henry David Thoreau once went up to Maine for a long camping trip, and he was totally freaked out. He went back to suburban Boston. I mean, being self-conscious in nature, we're not hunter-gatherers, and it can be spooky. I'm like, Eagle Scout, I love camping. I was in Australia, and you hear the totally different wildlife at night, and it's kind of creepy. We find in the New Testament, really, two religions, the religion of Jesus and the religion about him. Tend to focus on the religion of Jesus, his life and teachings. But here we have the other part, the religion about him, Jesus as the universal Redeemer. Now, among the Orthodox, Easter's the most important holiday of the year. They see it as the turning point in human history, wherein God made it possible for people to live forever. You Jews have not seen it that way, or at least not most of us, not that many of us. Few you Jews feel all that burdened by sin to begin with. I mean, we don't have a movement of penitentes or any of that. And besides, we don't believe that Easter provides us or anyone with a way to avoid death. For us, that is for many of those you use who try to make sense of this stuff, Easter affirms a mystically transformed life through death in the current moment, here and now. You still have to die, though. Eileen Pagel, I mean, you have to die psycho-emotionally. You have to let go of your ego, leave your ego at the door, and then you can maybe participate in this, Emerson calls an oversoul. Eileen Pagel, a professor of religion at Princeton University, has written extensively on how certain books made it into the New Testament, while others were cut. The ones that did not make it, not surprisingly, are the ones reflecting typical Unitarian Universalist views. Views that liberate individuals to act on their own, independent of church authority or priestly imprimatur. The author of the Gospel of Philip, for instance, writes Professor Pagels, was excoriated for arguing that the resurrection Jesus experienced was a paradigm for what could happen to anyone who underwent a spiritual transformation. Unitarian Universalists and those with UU views during earlier times, our historic progenitors, have pretty universally affirmed the more naturalistic and democratic understanding in all these matters. A Christology, well, Jesus asks his disciples, well, who do people say that I am? Well, what we say is a certain highly democratic and broadly shared reality of consciousness at the heart of our hearts. If we're part of nature, and nature's reborn every year, aren't we able to be reborn too? Yes, we are. As 24 hours camping at one of our beautiful state or national parks quickly makes clear to anyone, the renewal of the living world renews our own inner worlds as well. If we but take time to be in nature, she will renew herself in us and restore us with improved vitality and hope every time. When all is said and done, Easter's about rebirth. Rebirth in our hearts, our imaginations, our consciousness. Easter is our ability to see rebirth and redemption in the midst of it all, and to testify that hope and opportunity are always here in our midst, even when skeptics and fear-mongers would tell you otherwise on TV every day. We need to remember in the midst of life's struggles that life is filled with beauty too, and that it's regularly filled with beautiful spring blossoms, that despite the inevitability of death, something beautiful lives on around us and within every one of our hearts as well. Easter, essentially, is an attitude. Exemplified in the unfailing return of life, spring after spring, and also, and most importantly, in the return of love to one's heart. In our unwillingness to be beaten down and give up, even in the face of others' cynicism and brutality. Demystified, the essential story of Easter is this. Life is filled with many wintry Good Fridays, but also with an equal share of Easters. We shall see plenty of death, but also our share of resurrection. And as Babushka repeatedly exclaimed, truly, it's a miracle. The human spirit is capable in ways not short of miraculous, of triumphing against all odds, and indeed does so again and again, and will no doubt continue to as long as we live on the earth. Let us then resolve this day to remember we are part of nature, and just as nature rebirths itself every spring, we can be reborn whenever we allow springtime into our hearts. Let us resolve to do this today and every day. Hallelujah.